Welcome to the stream. I'm Ahmed Shahabuddin. As Russian troops continue their assault on Ukraine, Western governments have tightened sanctions against Russian leaders and entities while publicly supporting Ukrainian popular resistance and opening their borders to refugees. But Palestinian leaders and commentators say such backing is absent for people enduring Israel's illegal occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, as well as its blockade of Gaza. Today, we ask why there are such double standards in mainstream support for people resisting occupation. Joining us today, Khaled Baydoun is a law professor at Wayne State University and a scholar in national security and civil rights. He's in the U.S. city of Detroit. Also, Ines Abdelrizeh is advocacy director for the Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy, an independent Palestinian organization. She is joining us from occupied East Jerusalem. And from Gaza, we have Mohammed Rafiq Mhawash. He is a writer and a journalist. And a quick reminder, we want you to be part of this conversation too, so send me your comments and questions in our YouTube chat and I'll bring them straight to our guests. Thank you all for being with us. I want to start, Ines, with you. You are enduring and living under Israel's occupation. I'm curious what it's been like for you to watch how the world has sort of rallied behind Ukraine's right to resistance and how you compare that with your own right to resist.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be with you. It's been, I think, very frustrating and infuriating for Palestinians to see, how Palestinians have been criminalized, gaslighted, and I think, constantly being told that they don't have a right to resist or that they're terrorists or that they're anti-Semites just for asking our rights. Our national rights are being denied, and so we're seeing completely an opposite reaction and very clear, accountability sanctions that are being taken in 2 weeks. And for Palestinians, this has been ongoing for 74 years.
Yeah, it's certainly glaring to many, these sort of hypocrisies and double standards. I do want to play what the president of Palestine, Mahmoud Abbas, had to say. With the U.S. Secretary of State sitting next to him, it's not as if these grievances are not being made in diplomatic channels. Let's take a listen.
The current events in Europe have shown blatant double standards, despite the crimes of the Israeli occupation that amounts to ethnic cleansing and racial discrimination, as recognized by human rights organizations, in addition to the attack on sanctities and the lack of respect for international law. We find no one who is holding Israel responsible for behaving as a state above the law.
Khaled, when you hear Ines and you hear Mahmoud Abbas there making essentially the same claim, right? We've seen this kind of horrific series of human rights violations in Ukraine, and we've seen other atrocities happen. We've seen the international response really being unified, being robust. But also being hypocritical. To you, what are the most striking hypocrisies or double standards, and is it constructive to point them out?
Yeah, I think it is. I think the immediate reaction that that I had, and I think individuals globally had, was the racial and racist dimensions of it all, that we could embrace and laud freedom fighters who were white, who were blonde-haired, blue-eyed, obviously being echoed by pundits who took the news immediately after the invasion. But once you dig deeper into the racial and racist dimensions of it all and the juxtaposition as to why Palestinians can't get the same, mm-hmm. not even the same, but the, a semblance of humanity that Ukrainians get, is the real politic of it all, right? That, Ukraine has special coveted significance for, Western nations, Western media outlets. And Palestine still occupies a position of oppositionality with regard to those real political interests. So it's the immediate reaction was one of race and racism. But once you dug in deeper, you realize that race and racism have a big part to play
right, with
how real politic is deployed.
And I want to talk more about racism, about the real politic, the geopolitics of this all, which is obviously also influencing a lot of this disparity that we're discussing. Mohammed, before we do that, I want to come to you because, you're living in Gaza. You're working as a journalist. And as you watch sort of Western governments, as well as Western companies, kind of fall over themselves to get in line to sanction Russia, to boycott Russia, to divest from Russia, and citing... Russian aggression, citing the fact that They're bombing hospitals. They're bombing schools. They're bombing journalists. Things that you have endured living in Gaza just this past summer, but also many years before. How does it feel, Muhammad? And where does your mind go? What comes to your mind?
Yes, I think it is really shockingly surprising to recall all the events happening over the past 2 weeks. But I think it's really necessary to get a little bit of memory of the time this whole crisis struck since the first Russian troops set foot in Ukraine in February 24th. I mean, the media has been watching and covering and applauding the Ukrainian people's bravery and resilience with, you know, notably increased stances coming out of Washington supporting Ukraine's right to self-defense and resistance and to sovereignty. And then, you know, hundreds of civilians took up arms and joined Ukrainian armed troops as soon as Russia began the invasion, you know, to defend their homeland against an indisputably superior power. And even after shells started to rain on cities and civilians and started devastating military infrastructure and residential areas alike, we have seen, you know, brave troops and civilians calling it clear that they will continue to fight for their nation's freedom until the very end. But before I get to more deep views, I guess we should declare a nation's, like, right to resist and fight an occupation or illegal military jurisdiction over right. the people, regardless of the circumstances surrounding the area, whether geopolitical or whatsoever.
And you know, I think so much of this, Muhammad, sorry to cut you off, but so much of this really does beg the question, is this about human rights? Or is this about Western hegemony? Is this about geopolitical aims? Is this about shifting alliances? The reason I ask is it's not just Palestine. So many other, whether you want to call them genocides, ethnic cleansings, collective punishments. I mean, Khaled, we've seen time and time again this selective championing of human rights. And I kind of want to ask you, based on what we heard from Muhammad, and by the way, please feel free to jump in, right? Because otherwise we'll never get to everything we want to get to. But Muhammad brought something up that was very interesting. If you take a look at my screen, Khaled, this is how the Independent, one news organization, but countless have kind of been, I would even say, glorifying the Molotov cocktails that we've seen Ukrainians throw at Russian soldiers. Ukraine's government encouraging citizens to make the bombs. We've seen that same thing happen, you know, in the Western media, in Western politicians, you know, championing this movement of mass Molotov cocktail manufacturing. And to me, it's so glaring because if you look at this article from Haaretz, you know, this is just a couple weeks ago as this was all playing out, you know, Mohammed Salah, one young Palestinian boy, just one of several who were killed by Israeli soldiers for intending to use a Molotov, intending to use a Molotov cocktail. How is it that an intention justifies your murder in the context of Palestine, Khaled, but somehow in Ukraine it's not only glorified or praised, but it's seen as expected and normal?
Yeah, that's the whole absurdity of this all, right? Is that the object matters less than the individual, the subject carrying the object. So in the case of Palestinians, the fact that it's a brown boy who was Arabi and who, you know, is tied to this, you know, terrorist threat that's been constructed over the last 20 years of the war on terror eliminates the Molotov cocktail from being an instrument of liberation, an instrument of freedom fighting. But once you take that object and put it in the hands of a white subject, a Ukrainian subject, immediately they're being lauded, they're being celebrated. These are freedom fighters. The word terrorist never pops up on any of the media coverage when it comes to Ukrainians. So, you know, it's baffling, it's frustrating. But then again, when you step back and realize that the media has a very, you know, strategic political objective, and they've been just as complicit in the propagation of how we think about terrorism, how we think about freedom fighting from a specifically racial lens.
And, you know, Ines, I wonder what you think about that, the role of the media and racism, which, you know, we heard Khaled reference. Is it fair to say that the mainstream media are signaling essentially to the world that if white lives are being attacked, that somehow that's that warrants swift action, that warrants accountability? I mean, obviously, it's not just race, but what do you think is what does this suggest about international law moving forward and how it will or will not be applied?
Yeah. Of course, it plays a big role. I wouldn't say I don't understand, you know, when Europeans get more empathy towards their neighboring Europeans. I mean, that's a human being will always be more empathetic to their neighbor. However, here, clearly, when it comes to Arabs, Muslims, and what Khaled just said, there is a presumption of guilt. And I think it's at play as well in Israel and Palestine, right? Like Israel, this wants to present itself as this beacon of the Western world. It's a European settler colony that is surrounded by, you know, Arabs, and we're not even seen as Palestinians. What we're seen as these Arabs without, again, national identity. I think this plays a huge role because automatically when we, you know, throw a stone in the face of oppression, automatically this is seen as guilt and Israeli's reaction seen as more legitimate. And I think, you know, what you were saying about international law is very important because, and I have some form of optimism that all of this is exposed at the moment, but clearly there is a, you know, this massive hypocrisy when it comes to international law and the respect of it, as well as human rights that are supposed to be universal. And again, we're seeing here that suddenly international law is again at the center of, you know, the scene, at the center of discussions and geopolitics, when on the one hand, you see Russia has been going actually getting away with everything in Chechnya,
right,
in Georgia, et cetera, but also Israel for decades has been completely, you know, getting away with total impunity when it comes to crimes that have been documented again and again.
And I wonder what that impunity actually does, not just for other populations who are fighting resistance or seeking basic human dignity, but when you allow it in one instance, which for Israel, you know, it's been true for decades. I just wonder, Mohammed, listening to what Inas said and knowing that we've seen, you know, Russia thrown out of the World Cup by FIFA, despite Palestinians calling for Israel to be thrown out, but that not happening. We've even seen, you know, Russian cats now can't compete in international competitions, according to the Federation, International Federation of Feline, you know, Cats. I mean, I bring these points up not to make fun of what's happening, but just to show the extreme difference in the way the media is reacting and individual organizations. Mohammed, living in Gaza, enduring that erasing by the media, or at least the dehumanization that we, you know, the mainstream media has become known for when it comes to covering this and your life. I mean, what do you see as the role in the media? What frustrates you most about it?
Well, it's really devastating and frustrating. And I believe, dear Ahmed, in looking into things comparatively, I mean, on the other side of the world, we must say that Palestinians have been up fighting for, you know, basic human rights for not only a week or two or even months, but for seven continued decades. And we ourselves know exactly what it is to be like under oppression and occupation very well. And I'm recalling here all the parts of historic Palestine, including Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza are, you know, pretty good examples. And the horrific attacks against Palestinians in those cities and places are typical of what it means to be under military occupation. I mean, hundreds of children killed and arrested, and many, many families have been swiped off the civil registry. And the continued ethnic cleansing of the indigenous Palestinian and the native populations since its track since, 1948. And I'm also, you know, recalling the pushing motive and reason for our struggle. It's really necessary to point this out that Palestinians, we never based our struggle on a course of, you know, race or heritage or culture, language or religion, but for the mere human rights from which we have been denied for over seven decades.
Yeah.
You know, like equality, justice, healthcare, education, and more importantly, above all, freedom, you know?
Right. And it's important for you to point out that it's not just about the right to resist invasion or occupation. It's about the right to just have basic human rights guaranteed. Even outside of... Yeah, please, Khaled, jump in.
Yeah, if I can jump in about your point about kind of the selective use of human rights or deployment of human rights. So I think the question that's fundamental to this conversation is what is international law and what is human rights? What purpose does international law have today, right? So we saw a couple of weeks ago how a regime, a government that is not only complicit but engineering one of the most destructive ethnic cleansing campaigns in the world. I'm talking about China here with regard to Uyghur Muslims, just staged the Winter Olympics, right? And a lot of Western governments, Western corporations didn't bat an eye, even though we have 2 million Uyghur Muslims locked in concentration camps, right? So the fact that we're punishing Russia for this invasion, which might be just, demonstrates that there's no symmetrical or equal application of international law. It's simply a geopolitical tool used by powerful governments to advance interests that align with their interests. And I think that this is another, you know, case of that. What makes me optimistic and really quick, sorry for speaking.
No, please.
I think these hypocrisies and contradictions intersect with a really interesting time. The fact that mainstream and legacy media are on the decline and digital media is on the incline. So I'm seeing, what I'm noticing is a lot of individuals on the ground all over the world are far more in tune to these contradictions than they were 10 or even 20 years ago.
No, and I appreciate you bringing that point up because, as we all know, you know, social media giants, these big companies, they've been rushing to take action to not only protect Ukrainians' free speech, but that while also silencing, really, and erasing Palestinian voices using the same justifications of, you know, their terms of service. We have a video comment that was sent to us by Mona Shtaya. She works, you know, in this regard, documenting these sort of disparities. Let's take a look at what she had to say.
We Palestinians have never witnessed any of the measures taken by social media platforms in support of Ukraine, despite the fact that we have long demanded many of them. These dramatically different policies in the context of wars and occupation illustrates a clear double standards when it comes to the Palestinian cause. For example, on Meta's blog, the company used the word resistance to describe Ukrainian people's right to fight against Russian invasion, while the word resistance itself was the very reason why some Palestinian content was taken down from Meta's platform. This systematic hypocrisy is allowing the occupier to pursue hate speech and incitement against oppressed people without holding them accountable or censoring their content, which leads to a real-world harm.
Khaled, I'm going to come back to you, and then Ines, I would love to hear from the rest of you too. I'm going to come back to you to push back a little bit. I mean, it is encouraging, hopeful that we're seeing the decline of centralized media, but then we're also seeing these social media companies kind of echo some of these same disparities and double standards. I mean, changing their hate speech policy temporarily to allow people to call for the annihilation of Russian soldiers, Russia, Russian individuals, while we saw since last summer Palestinians who not only are, let's say they're not calling for the annihilation of Israel, no, they're simply saying Palestine has, you know, a right to exist, and that's seen as inciting violence or that violates their terms. I mean, doesn't that give you some pessimism, or should we be optimistic?
No, I think that's exactly right. And the comments you made, I think, lean to what I call a qualified optimism, right? The fact, look, I was victim of being shadow banned on Instagram, on Twitter, when I was posting about Palestine last year, right? So I had specific posts that were removed, and this is happening at a far more intense level for individuals within the occupied territories, but also places like Kashmir in India. We're seeing big tech corporations, which work really closely and collaboratively with governments like the United States, like India, like Israel, to make sure that activists and dissidents on the ground in their countries don't have the virtual platforms, don't have the ability to speak and bring to light issues that are happening on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's interesting to me to hear you say that. And Ines, I want to hear from you, because this silencing, this censorship, or the criminalization of Palestinian voices, you know, whether about resistance or anything else, I can't help but notice. I mean, there's this, I don't know if you've seen this, on March 3rd, there's a representative named Lee Zeldin. Take a look at my screen here. This is a Republican from New York. He introduced the Israel Anti-Boycott Act. This is essentially to criminalize any boycott or calls for boycott against Israel. This was one day after he tweeted this on Twitter, saying the U.S. should immediately stop the importation of all Russian oil, ramp up domestic energy production instead. And, you know, I think this is such a strong juxtaposition. He's calling for sanctioning or boycotting Russian oil. But at the same time, we've seen 35 states have laws, resolutions, and executive orders restricting or trying to do what this act that he's introduced is trying to do. When you see these efforts, and we just heard from Khaled, you know, him being shadow banned, and I know you're familiar with others on the ground in Palestine, where do you have hope that this moment can maybe clarify some of these double standards?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as activists, I think on the ground, and we work a lot actually with our friends at Hemle, where Mona works, to document and to fight this. We spend a lot of energy actually trying to, you know, push back against accusation and criminalization. So the strategy has been very clear for many years now, and it actually can mirror quite a bit the tactics of Russia, right, on disinformation and criminalization of Ukrainian voices. Basically, Israel has been pushing, you know, the politicized definition of anti-Semitism in mm-hmm. order to label any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. And on the other hand, accusing Palestinians of being terrorists, you know, NGOs that do tremendous work on the ground. The problem is that when it comes to the West, and this is both from like corporations, again, social media platforms, but from also governments, is that,
right.
You know, when Israel says something, it's taken to face value and they're kind of listened to as in good faith, as in there's some bits of truth to what they're saying, even if it's right. latent, like disinformation and lies. Whereas,
right.
you know, when you obviously hear like Russia or you watch Russia disinformation, there's an automatic reaction that obviously this might be bots or this might be disinformation, or when it comes to China, for that matter.
And you know, Jalal Abu Khatir, who's a journalist in occupied East Jerusalem, he sent us some thoughtful comments that kind of refer to some of what you were talking about there. Let's take a listen and then I'll come back to you, Muhammad.
Israel has not been able to come up with one coherent response towards the Russian invasion into Ukraine. Israeli leadership is fumbling. They are paying lip service when it comes to condemning atrocities. We are seeing the evidence. We are witnessing the war crimes committed in Ukraine by Russian invaders. And we are also understanding that Israel is unable to condemn those war crimes because Israel itself is accused of such war crimes. Only last summer, Human Rights Watch accused Israel of committing probable war crimes in Gaza during the indiscriminate bombing of civilian population in Gaza. Similarly, in the West Bank, there are cases in The Hague currently where Israel is accused of war crimes because of the violations of the Geneva Conventions, where it is displacing Palestinians under occupation and replacing them with Jewish settlers from abroad.
Muhammad, in our YouTube chat, Marty1970 is asking, why don't we ban Israel from the Human Rights Council at the UN? I don't know if you're familiar. Today, there was actually a vote. If you look at my screen here, these are all the countries that voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council at the UN. Just 2 weeks ago, the same body, the Human Rights Council, accused Israel of being guilty of the crime of apartheid under international law. And even though they did that, you know, at the same time, we see Israel now voting to suspend Russia, even though they don't believe in this body. I mean, it never ends, right, these double standards and hypocrisies. But in your mind, what should the world be paying attention to?
Yes, I think it's been really understandable after four major wars in Gaza from time to time. It has made it clear enough that fighting a military violation or aggression against your people is totally, you know, dependent on the identity of your aggressor, you know, with no regard to the human tragic consequences on the people on the ground. So a simple media coverage comparison between the coverage of the Ukraine, Russia aggression and Gaza clearly showed bias and seems steered towards the European struggle by the Western media, not uplifting the Palestinian, let's say, responsive resistance that carried out defending the civilian right. populations of Palestinians in Gaza.
Yeah, and
you know, and so the Ukrainian,
Well, sorry, I don't want to cut you off. We don't have a lot of time left. I do want to just point to this point that Jalal made, Muhammad Khalid. Jalal was talking about how Israel is trying this balancing act. Of course, they violate Syria's sovereignty with thousands of airstrikes, just as Russia has for the better part of a decade. And there was no accountability. Now that it happens to white, European, modernized Ukrainians, forgive me for speaking so freely. You know, we're seeing accountability. What do you make of Israel's role in these geopolitical shifts? The UAE and Saudi ignoring the U.S., Israel being condemned by the U.S. Khalid?
Look, this is where I think race and even the broader war on terror is very, very salient, right? And that pundit for NBC who says Europe is civilized and the Middle East is uncivilized. So if Israel takes the position that it is sort of the one civilized actor in this broader uncivilized region, then essentially it has the ability to police with impunity people who live in this uncivilized region, whether they're Palestinian, Syrian, Arab at large. But when it takes place in Europe, when it takes place in the bastion of civilization, even though the bastion of civilization is responsible for the two world wars, where it was responsible for the genocide of Bosnian Muslims 25 years ago, then it's abhorrent, right? It shocks the conscience. So Israel, in some respects, is capitalizing on its identity as being a white settler colonial state within this broader ocean of uncivilized people.
And Khalid, I'm glad you broadened it out there and made all those historical references. That's actually all the time we have for today. I'm going to end on a tweet from Hanan Ashrawi. Unless the victim is white, European, Christian, resistance is terrorism. International law doesn't apply. Refugees have no right to return. That's all the time we have. Catch us. You can read that tweet. You can find it on Twitter. Find us on stream.aljazeera.com. Thanks for watching.